serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Del Blomquist, a Navy veteran of World War II and the Korean War. Before the break, you heard him relate a moment aboard the cargo ship USS Ganymede when a Japanese plane was circling overhead. As Del and the rest of the crew waited for a bomb to fall, the pilot recognized the ship had already unloaded all of its war material and was high in the water. So he moved on to target another ship, and the Ganymede was spared.
Sorry if these are obvious questions, but I think I hear you saying that if you hadn't been empty, if you still had some of that cargo on board, the bomb probably would have dropped.
It would have, no doubt about it. Yeah, we had got completely unloaded, so they could tell that we weren't worth the bomb.
I can tell you've had occasion or two to reflect on that over the years. You know, it's been more than 70 years since that happened. Does a situation like that give you some perspective on how fleeting life is, or how minute details can change the course of your life?
Oh, yeah. Always, when you've been through anything that's close to taking your life, you remember it, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made me believe more in God than ever before.
Yeah. And I hear you saying that, and you say it with a smile, but I don't think you're joking. It sounds like that was a real deal.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I really gave my life to God. After I got on that ship and headed to the South Pacific, I said, here I am. Do whatever you think is fair. I'm with you. That's it. And I believe it. Because a lot of things have happened that I can only think there was some divine intervention that had something to do with it.
Well, and, you know, I don't want to pry, but it sounds like you're willing to share on that. And as I hear you describe that, is there a sense of peace that comes from that when you make that bargain or you make that commitment?
Yes. Yeah, you just decide there's no sense in worrying about it. It'll be taken care of.
And when you say there have been a lot of situations that you can't explain otherwise, that you look back on and you see the hand of God intervening, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you what those are.
I had a lot of little things happen to me, and I think about why if that had just been this way, I would not be here today. And I think everybody has those situations happen. But one story that I read about just definitely sold me on divine intervention is there was a U.S. cruiser with a doctor aboard that had a sick bay down below the waterline on the port side. He was working on a sailor down in his sick bay, mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there was a big loud thump on the side of the ship. So he just got through working on the sailor. He went up and talked to somebody topside. What's going on? He says, well, there was a Japanese submarine order just fired 3 torpedoes at us. One of them hit the side of the ship and didn't go off. The other one missed us, went around the fantail. The other one came right midships of the cruiser. When it got close, it dove, went underneath the cruiser, and came up on the other side. Now, that's a that's divine intervention.
Yeah, that's hard to explain right there. And what about yourself for the rest of the war? So, you've given us a couple highlights of your time aboard that cargo ship. Any other experiences that stand out before you got that great news that Japan had surrendered?
Like I say, a cargo ship's not the liveliest of assignments as far as shooting down things and hitting people. But, there were like the situation where I was in the shower. That, to me, that was amazing, and having that ship did not break in half. Thankful to the fact that the Navy put a steel band around it. Yeah, that was good. No, I didn't have any other thing that I can think of offhand right now that was really outstanding. It was just normal seagoing cargo ship.
Well, yeah, and what about that? Because when we think about World War II, you know, people will think about the guys flying the P-38s or the guys charging the beaches or the big battles like Lady Gulf where all the battleships are raging. They don't think about the logistics. They don't think about the supplies that need to be transported. They don't think about how none of that could happen without people moving the pieces in place. So how do you feel about the role that your ship played in the big picture?
Well, you just said it. Our mission was to keep moving stuff up. Behind the war, we didn't have the guns or the ability to fight it out with anything. You know, we only had a 5-inch 38 on the stern to help shoot down airplanes. We had a 3-inch gun on the bow, which later was changed to 240 millimeters. So we weren't what you'd call heavily armed. Yeah. We were more susceptible to be sunk by today than a lot of other ships. We didn't even have radar on our ship when we first left the States. Going into Milne Bay one time on the Straits, it was raining so hard the captain couldn't see where we were going, and he sent a young officer up in the bow with a pair of binoculars and the telephone so he could contact the bridge. And it wasn't too long that this young officer kept yelling, "Back down, back down, back down." So the captain got her back down and stopped and dropped the anchor. And the next morning we looked up and there was an island. We were headed right for that island. It rained 16 inches in 24 hours.
Yeah, there's another close enough call for you. Well, what about the end of the war? Do you remember where you were and how you found out that it was all over?
I was on the ship, and we were anchored in Zamboanga in the Philippines when they dropped the bomb. And we all just thought that was wonderful, jumped up and down, had a celebration. They even gave us two beers on the ship, which is unheard of. So we enjoyed it, and that was the end of hostilities. Because if you've ever seen what they were planning on doing on the invasion of Japan, if we had to do that, it would have killed millions of people. But fortunately, after dropping the bomb, we didn't have to do that, and it was a celebration aboard ship.
Well, and I understand the timing of your coming back home here to Tulare was cause for celebration, too.
Yeah, when we finally got through with what we had to do after the war was over, we came back into San Francisco Bay, and I got off the ship and walked into my home here in Tulare on my 21st birthday, and I had two bottles of Australian beer in my sea bag, one for Dad and one for me. That was a good celebration, too. I cannot really fully understand what my mother must have gone through for the 28 months that I was gone. Just terrible.
Well, and I'm just thinking about that moment. You know, I bet how many people would love to have a moment like that. You know, you're out there risking your life for more than 2 years. You come home on your birthday, and you get to share a toast with your dad.
Yeah, that was a thing to remember forever. The beer is very good, too. Australian beer was excellent. It's 10% alcohol. You had to be careful.
What about transitioning after the war is over? And all of a sudden, you're a civilian again. Was it easy to pick back up with life, or did that take a while?
Of course, I got $300 muster and out pay. I had a little time to spend that and enjoy what was going on. It wasn't too long, I think, I met my bride-to-be in February, 46. So I didn't waste much time. And we got married in July of 46. No, I didn't have much trouble. I can't say enough good about the thing that the government did for the servicemen, give them money to go to school and things like that, you know, GI Bill. I immediately went to work when I knew I was going to get married. Thought I better get a job. So I went to work as an apprentice in Valley Refrigeration, learning the refrigeration and air conditioning business. But about a year and a half, I decided that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be associated with aircraft. So I took my GI Bill and went to school up at Oakland Airport, got my certified mechanics license. That was where I really, really enjoyed what I was doing and stuck with it. Became a Pratt & Whitney aircraft engine field representative for 30 years later on. Wonderful company to work for, and I love the job.
You mentioned Pratt & Whitney. I'm sure you have a handle for the role Pratt & Whitney engines played in the air war during World War II.
Oh, yeah. As you know, I did not fly any of these things, but I worked on some of those aircraft engines afterwards. But I soon rotated into the jet business, helped train people and provide technical advice and so on and so forth on the jet engines.
Well, and I'm just curious, did you think your Navy days were over?
Yeah, I thought so, but when I was working for a little airline at Oakland Airport after I got my license, the guys kept saying, "Come on, join the Naval Air Reserve. Just like a lodge, we have a lot of fun, and do this, do that. So June of 1950, I went down to the Naval Air Reserve and joined. 2 weeks later, the Korean War broke out. And they called a land-based Navy patrol squadron into active duty, and they were filling all the billets. Well, they needed a master at arms, and that's what a bosun does, too. So they called me in to be a master at arms in that land-based patrol squadron. It was really something to go back into the Navy after being in civilian life for a while, and also to be the person in charge of where the sailors are going to live and to make sure that they all live in this barracks the way the Navy taught them to live. The first day I walked into that barracks, it looked like a disaster. They just hadn't quite got the word yet. You're in the Navy again, buddy. So anyway, I got that squared away, and we all turned to be good sailors. And then we went up to Sand Point Naval Air Station on Lake Washington by Seattle, and we did some training out of there. And then we went in January of 52, we went to Japan for 6 months. And the squadron's mission was to drop flares on the roads at night where the trucks were headed south, and the fighters then would go in and hose the trucks. So that was their mission. Fortunately, I didn't have to go to Korea. I was able to stay in Japan where the squadron was based. They used to send detachments over to Korea, so I never got to Korea. That's okay with me.
But those planes from your squadron were performing an important function in Korea for those shipping routes.
That's true. And we were based at Atsugi, and near Tokyo, and then we got transferred down to Iwakuni. That's down in South Japan. 3 months one place, 3 months the other, so a 6 month tour.
Well, and I'm sure it was different being on land during the Korean War than being at sea going so slowly in World War II, but seems like there's another big difference there, too. You were married this time. Did that change things for you? Did that make it more challenging?
I hated to have to leave him for 6 months. I was very emotionally upset when I had to leave. In fact, I think I got seasick before the ship left the dock. But I got over it. But yes, I hated to leave the family. I had one son at the time. I have two now.
Well, and that's been a long, long time. And as you mentioned, you're in the aircraft business, and you told us earlier you got into flying gliders, to soaring, and you did that for 40 years till you were 90 years old. What kept you at that so long? What did you get out of it that made you keep doing it till you were 90?
Well, the idea of being able to learn where the lift is and to stay up and go someplace in a glider is a very challenging thing to do, and it's very interesting. Just something that I love to do, and I just kept going and going and doing it. And I met so many wonderful people, pilots and their families and friends. You get started doing something like that, and it's just, you just love it so much you can't get away from it.
So in 40 years of flying gliders, every single one of your landings was perfect?
All except one or two. There was every time I took off and was going to go across, there's always a chance that you were going to land out someplace. And the only time I had damaged the glider was I had to land out, and I landed on a road, but soon saw a fence in front of me, a gate. It was closed. So I pulled the stick back and jumped over the fence, and in the process I drifted off the line of the road that I was on and landed in some rough territory. And there was a big rock there that hit the bottom of my wing, so I damaged it. But that's all. I never really had any other trouble.
How'd you explain that one to your wife?
She said, "I told you so." No. No, and fortunately, it wasn't that bad. She said, "I told you so." No. No, and fortunately, it wasn't that bad a deal, and so we just lived with it.
Well, if we're going to talk about the powerless aircraft, I have to ask you about one trip on an aircraft with plenty of power. First time I had the privilege of meeting you, I think you were wearing your full Navy uniform, if I remember correctly, and you were blowing that bosun's pipe, because you were one of many veterans who got to go to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Yeah. And visit the World War II Memorial, the Korean War Memorial, the Navy Memorial, and more. What did you get out of that? What was that experience like for you?
That was one of the most memorable things I've ever been involved in. The honor flight was just wonderful. And I can't say enough for Al Perry and all the people involved to put that together. It's just a wonderful event. And anybody that has a chance to do that should do it, because it's just wonderful.
Well, and you've shared some of the things that were going through your mind during the war. When you're there looking at the World War II Memorial and you see that wall of gold stars and it's representing 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war, what was going through your mind?
I was very fortunate to be home. I did not think I was going to come back from World War II. You think about those kind of things when you see a memorial like that. That is a wonderful memorial. One of those things that you soak up and it just stays with you. Yeah, I thought about that at the time, that I'm very fortunate to be able to come back to this and not be at the bottom of the sea someplace.
And I know there are a lot of different things you did on that flight, on that experience, and it's been a few years now, but was there one element of that experience or one moment that kind of was the most satisfying or meaningful to you?
On the trip home, mail call. To receive mail call like that, which is a bunch of letters from the young kids around the area that wrote little notes and things for you as a veteran, that to me was one of the most memorable parts of that flight, the mail call.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm wondering if maybe that mail call, that whole experience, convinced you that people cared, that they valued what you did for our country.
Oh, yeah. It goes on and on and on. I run into people all the time that make a special point to come up and say, thank you for your service. It's wonderful.
Well, I know there's a lot of people in Tulare who think you're pretty wonderful, and they think you're a good musician, too. You're still playing in the Tulare Community Band?
Well, I was, except 6 months ago or something. I wound up with macular degeneration and bad enough I couldn't read the music. But I'm hoping to get back into it when with these shots that I'm taking now, right now, I've improved it a little bit. So I think eventually I might be able to get back into it.
You keeping your lips in shape? Because a trumpeter needs to have some pretty strong lips.
Yeah, I don't do it enough, but I do practice once in a while, just, you know, run through the scales and things just to keep your embouchure, lips,
right,
in shape. Yeah, you got to do that. I enjoyed it. And when I was in high school, we had a dance band, and I played lead trumpet in that, too, and that was very enjoyable. And I also played in a band when I got back from World War II over in Porterville on Saturday nights at the Green Mill. That was enjoyable. And big band music, to me, is my really first love music. Every time I get a chance to see it, like, there's the traveling bands. One comes through here once in a while that's called Glenn Miller. I just make a point to go see those guys. They're wonderful.
You take a little sentimental journey, huh?
Yeah, that's true.
A few things I want to ask before we wrap up, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that you'd say as you get ready to turn 94 years old that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful to be here, for one thing. It's like, was it George Burns? Went someplace and the guy says, hey, it's good to see you, George. This is my age, it's good to be anywhere. And that's where I am now. It's good to be anywhere. I just enjoy people and I like to do what I can to help people and just going along with whatever turns up, deal with it and have fun.
Well, and, you know, I don't want to be trite, but I'm curious what your secret is, because I interview a lot of guys in their 90s, and, I mean, I don't think you even have much gray hair up there. You got a full head of hair. You're still playing your trumpet if you want to. You just quit flying gliders a couple years ago. How do you stay so youthful at this age?
I eat 3 meals a day. None of it's high-fat food. Lots of fruits, you know, apples, oranges, and things like that. I think that diet has a lot to do with the way a person's body works. I try to eat good food and not much of it. I eat about half as much as I used to. Exercise a little, keep it up, and just establish a routine where you get those kind of things done. It's easy to put them off. As far as I think the genes my father and mother had are probably a lot to do with it. I take it as a blessing and try to keep it going.
Thank you to Del Blomquist. He turns 94 years old December 20th. Find photos of Del then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.